I'm going to say more numbers. After I say them, I want you to put them backward. 2, 8, 5, 1, 6.
6, 1, 5, 8, 2.
4, 1, 6, 4, 3.
3, 4, 6, 1, 4, 2. Hi, Mama. Mm-hmm. I think I probably have a little greater than 50% chance of getting it. I have lately thought, you know, you got about another 10 years of memory left before you hit your mom's stage. I absolutely am terrified of it.
That's from a PBS Nova documentary called Determined, Preventing Alzheimer's Disease, focused on studies here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Alzheimer's disease affects millions of Americans. Record-breaking studies at the UW-Madison have led to a new understanding of this devastating disease, its generational impact, and pathways to treatment. Joining me to discuss preventing Alzheimer's disease is Sterling Johnson, the Jean Finley Professor of Geriatrics and Dementia at the UW-Madison and the lead researcher for RAP, the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, a longitudinal study of over 1,700 people at risk for Alzheimer's disease. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It is such an important topic for pretty much every family. Every family I know is dealing with some relative within their extended family that faces some kind of memory loss or dementia or Alzheimer's. What led you personally into this area of research where Alzheimer's disease is really the focus of your research?
Yeah, that's I didn't have any personal family with this disease. But looking back now, I've had several relatives who've had it since I got into this studying this disease. I got into it from a memory neuroscience perspective. I have been studying different forms of memory and how memory is degraded. And Alzheimer's disease back in those days, back in the 90s, that was an important model for understanding how memory is formed and how it degrades over time.
Can you give us a definition of Alzheimer's disease and how it differs from other forms of dementia and memory loss?
That's a really fundamental question, and it's one that we have trouble even to this day communicating. Alzheimer's disease is a cause of dementia. Dementia is the phase of the disease where a person no longer is able to function the way they used to function. They may not be able to remember where their car was or who their the details of their family, and their memory and other cognitive functions have degraded to the point where they just can't function like they used to, and they're no longer independent. So that's the dementia phase of Alzheimer's disease. There's a phase upstream from that. We call it mild cognitive impairment. And prior to that, this disease can exist for 20 plus years in people who don't have any symptoms. So Alzheimer's is the cause of a symptom. It's really defined by the proteins that accumulate in the brain abnormally, amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. Those are the two major causes that jointly give rise to Alzheimer's disease. And that's what the neuropathologists would look at under a microscope after a person has passed away. That's how they define it. We often think of Alzheimer's as that dementia phase of the illness. And by that time, a person may have not only Alzheimer's disease, but they may have other things going on that contribute to that dementia, including vascular disease and other causes of neurodegeneration that we can get into.
So of all the cases of dementia that are there, what percentage would you say would be from Alzheimer's? And if you have dementia but it's not Alzheimer's, you don't have those two proteins that are the markers, then yeah. What else could it be?
Such a great question. We don't have a complete answer to that because not everybody goes to autopsy, so we can't definitively see what else is there. But of the people who have gone to autopsy and the studies that have been done, it's approximately, I'd say, 70%. When it looks like Alzheimer's clinically, about 70% of the time it's actually Alzheimer's disease, maybe a little higher. But there's other diseases that can masquerade as Alzheimer's disease. And that's where – that's the frontier of our field. That's where we're putting a lot of effort right now. We want to know what it is that's causing the memory impairment and the cognitive decline so that we can treat it with the right therapy.
And how common would you say Alzheimer's is? Let's say you take 500 people. Percentage-wise, what would you expect in terms of the number of those 500 people that are going to have Alzheimer's?
I know the number is over age 65. And if you look at age 65 or above, of those 500 people, about 50 would have Alzheimer's disease. And if you go to age 85, then you're looking more around maybe 200 or 250 would have Alzheimer's changes. Yeah. And they may not all have symptoms yet, but about half those individuals would have the disease in their brain at age 85.
And then early onset, how common is that?
Well, early onset would be maybe two different things. First of all, there's early onset due to genetics, and that's very rare. And then there's early onset, which is maybe defined as dementia or really significant symptoms prior to the age of 65. That's also rare, but that's maybe 5 or 10% of the cases with Alzheimer's disease have that early onset. And then the people who have the genetic mutations, those are just extraordinarily rare and valuable cases to study to understand the pathology.
You know, I opened with a little clip from the NOVA documentary that was done about the work you're doing here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and it focused on three families in particular. It shows the devastating effect of Alzheimer's on caregivers, on children who then – adult children who are worried they're going to have it themselves since there is that genetic link. And you can see the fear on the faces of the participants when they're taking those memory tests, you know, where you're given a string of numbers or string of words and you're supposed to say them backwards or draw some shape you've been shown for a second. And you can see that sort of panicky feeling as they worry, oh my, is my memory failing? Is this a sign of Alzheimer's? You know, one question I guess I would have is, to what extent is memory loss also a natural process of aging? You know, people refer to the senior moment when you can't pull up a noun or, you know, remember somebody's name. To what extent is memory loss sort of normal aging, and when does it become not normal?
Mm-hmm. It is a part of normal aging. We all have memory failures, where we parked our car or what we did yesterday or the week before. It becomes a problem when it starts interfering on a consistent basis with our everyday life. And it really becomes a problem when it starts influencing our relationships with our family and our financial well-being and our health. If we're forgetting to take our medicines or neglecting self-care or can't remember the family members who are trying to help us and making those financial questionable decisions that people with dementia may end up making, that's when it becomes a problem. And so it's something that if a person is concerned about it, they should watch it. And if it gets worse over time, or if it's something that they're just want to get checked out, they should. They should get it checked with their doctor. And there'll be some tests that could be ordered that could just check their memory and their brain health to see if things are going okay.
And how do you get a baseline for that? Let's say, for example, that you test someone who's 65 and you get a sort of memory test on that person. I would think there'd be a lot of variation with another 65-year-old in terms of what they could do when they were in their 20s. You know, not everybody can count backwards and do patterns and draw things standardized tests are often, you know, they give you a snapshot of somebody, but there's variation too.
There's
how
such
do,
a range.
How do you build in sort of a baseline?
Yeah, there is such a range on those standard tests. People have different skills and ability levels on these things. So it is. It's important to get a baseline in late midlife or early old life in our 60s and maybe early 70s when we're still healthy. Get a baseline and we can watch how things progress from there. That's the luxury we have on the research side. We do get a baseline in midlife and we can compare a person's future testing to that baseline and we can see if there's significant decline for them. Our healthcare system may not be set up just yet to do these baselines in everyday clinical medicine, but hopefully we'll get there.
So tell me about RAP, the Wisconsin Registry of Alzheimer's Prevention. I read somewhere it's sort of the largest study of its kind in the world.
Yeah, we think it is. It's the largest study of people who have a parent with presumed Alzheimer's disease. And this is largely a natural history study. In other words, an observational study. We're not giving medicines or drugs as part of the study. We're just watching people. We're measuring them carefully. We're understanding what kind of risk factors they have, genetic or environmental or health and lifestyle risk factors for dementia. And we watch people over time with these memory tests that we do every 2 years or so. And in addition to the memory tests, we do brain scans. We want to know if they have the Alzheimer's proteins in their brain, which we can detect with brain scans. We can also detect those proteins with spinal fluid tests. And these days, it's very exciting. We can actually detect some of these proteins with a simple blood test. And that's an exciting area for our field that's just now emerging.
Because you don't have to wait for an autopsy. It's something that you, where you get markers.
That's right.
So you started by saying that it's that you're working, studying, observing adult children with a parent with presumed Alzheimer's. So you don't do the scanning and blood work on the parent?
We don't do it on the parent. Often they've already passed away or they're not in a position to join a research study. So we're studying these adult children, and they've often been the ones who've taken their parent to the memory clinic to get tested and have been a caregiver for their parent. So they've seen this disease up close and personal. But that's one of the unifying features of our study early on at this is that these were going to be adult children of people with Alzheimer's disease. I think we can still say that, but I think we have to qualify it as that the parents had clinically diagnosed Alzheimer's disease. And as I mentioned earlier, that's not always the case, that once you get them to an autopsy or do the biomarkers on that parent, they may not have the disease.
But they have symptoms that make it look like that or would make it a good guess that that's what it is?
That's right. Yeah.
So let's say you're recruiting these adult children, and how many have you followed over time and for how long?
Yeah, we've got about 1,750 people in our study right now. We are going to be recruiting another 200 individuals over the next few years. And we've been in business since 2001. It was started by Mark Sager, a geriatrician here at UW. And he took this study quite a ways and had a lot of foresight into where we were going to be as a field and positioned us very well. I took over the study in 2014 and have tried to take it a little further with what I know about the disease and as this field has matured, especially around these biomarkers. We can now understand with such accuracy who has these proteins in their brain. And they do start to become detectable many, many years before any symptoms do. And it's creating a lot of possibilities for early detection so that we can get people into treatment studies or into the right therapy as those therapies come along.
Do you ever worry that diagnosing someone as having these proteins, having these markers that would suggest they will develop Alzheimer's, that it can do harm? Because you know how ignorance is bliss?
Yeah.
That if you know that you've got this. It's a little bit like those questions sometimes about cancer. You know, do you have this gene for breast cancer that your mother had? And mm-hmm. are you going to go ahead and do some surgery almost preventively? Will it make you so anxious and depressed and worried about what's coming that it'll be, devastating? And I guess that would be one question I'd ask is, how do you weigh the positive impact of knowing versus sort of the downside of giving someone that news?
Mm. It's a really important question, one that we've discussed many times over the years. And we've left it partly in the hands of our participants. If they want to know, they can know. Particularly around these amyloid brain scans, we can let them know their results if they want to know. But we don't mandate that they find out. It's up to them right now. I think as we get more therapies that'll be available to our participants and to the public over the next few years, this whole conversation will probably change. More people will want to know. They'll want to be empowered with that information so that they can make decisions in their best interest. And maybe for some people it'll be going on an experimental therapy or a recently approved therapy that pulls these amyloid plaques out of your brain. It's really extraordinary what these new medicines can do. And then some people may want to know because they want to plan. They want to get their family affairs lined up, their financial affairs and so forth. And other people may want to make lifestyle changes. They may want to exercise more or sleep more or see their kids more or do the things that are important to them to maintain brain health and maintain a high quality of life, given that this disease may be in their future if they have the amyloid proteins in their brain now.
So let me ask you a question. Let's say you take two people, and this is before you do the scans or anything. Take two people, two women. One mm-hmm. has a mother that was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. The other is a woman whose mother was not diagnosed with Alzheimer's, seems to be sharp and aged 90 and no signs of that. You have these two women, different family history. To what extent is the woman with the mother with Alzheimer's at higher risk for developing it herself? Is it like a 50% higher risk because of that? I guess I don't know how it works genetically.
Yeah, it's things that we are still finding out, and we don't know for sure how it works. But what we know now is that there's a gene. It's called APOE, apolipoprotein E, and this is the major risk factor gene for the late-onset Alzheimer's disease. And it increases your chance twofold if you have one copy. We inherit our genes from our mother and father, of course, and if you inherit this version of this gene from one of your parents, you're at higher risk. If you inherit it from both of your parents, you're at extremely high risk of getting this disease. That's very rare to be homozygous. That's the genetic term for having two copies mm-hmm. of this APOE allele. And when you're homozygous, which is about 5% of the population or less, your chance of Alzheimer's goes up about sixfold, six to eightfold from that 10% that I cited earlier. So it's really puts you at high risk. And but most people with family history, the risk the risk that we've been able to pinpoint is pretty much due to this APOE gene. Family history in and of itself doesn't provide any additional risk information. It's pretty much about this APOE gene right now.
I thought I read, too, that daughters were at higher risk. Is that correct? And if so, why?
That's been reported, and there's been research on that. And I don't know if that's ever been fully replicated or fully fleshed out. There was some speculation and some theory about certain DNA that we get from the mitochondrial DNA that is passed down from the mother, that could be something in play there. But I think that's not quite it's not fully formed yet in the research community.
You mentioned lifestyle is one thing that can help prevent Alzheimer's. You talked about some clinical trials of new medications. We're going to talk about that and more when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Okay. I just was wondering what you're doing, and I want to ask her. And to stay happy.
There's a voicemail that I keep. I listen to it just to hear you speak. A sun turns to silence just like that. No, I love you all goodbye. Like you saw the phone in your hand and you didn't know why. It's crazy how you come and go so fast. Oh, how do I get you back? If I could only see the cracks you're slipping through. Wish I didn't feel so helpless when it comes to helping you hold on. So I keep holding on to every little memory made of you and me. Every little glimpse of who you used to be. I know you're still in there. Deep down somewhere, I swear I still see you. Between the blank stares.
That's from the song Blank Stares by Jay Allen about his mother's early onset Alzheimer's. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Sterling Johnson, and we are talking about research on Alzheimer's disease here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, including the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, a longitudinal study of over 1,700 people at risk for Alzheimer's disease. We were talking about, you know, some of the genetic markers for Alzheimer's, the study that's underway now, starting in 2001, I think you said, following lots of people to see what happens in the course of the disease, if it develops or not. You mentioned that lifestyle is something that's also being looked at in terms of, let's say you have those markers that suggest you are at higher risk for Alzheimer's. What can you personally do in the face of what seems like a hopeless situation?
We are looking at things like exercise, and we have researchers here like Dr. Okonkwo, who is looking at that in a lot of detail. We're looking at diet. We're looking at sleep. We're looking at how well a person manages their other diseases like their diabetes or other things. What we are finding so far is that lifestyle has an impact on how fast a person will decline cognitively. It doesn't really impact yet, as far as we can tell, whether a person will develop these proteins or not. But if they do have those proteins, if a person is living right, so to speak, and exercising and doing all those things, they may be able to slow it down. We don't know by how much. If you exercise for 10 years, will you be buying yourself a year's worth of time or 10 years worth of time?
And does it matter how much exercise?
Yeah.
How?
These are things we don't know, and that's a big reason for the study right now. It's one of the things we're looking at. And many of the link studies to the RAP main study, we're trying to figure all that out.
Now, I've heard that people should, you know, keep doing crossword puzzles and keep their brain sharp, kind of like exercising those cognitive functions, that
yes.
That is a way to sort of stave off the disease as well. Is that a myth or has it been shown to be true?
It's been partially shown to be true, and it kind of depends. And we think it's important for people to stay sharp, to keep their mind engaged, to especially socially, keep yourself socially engaged and be physically active. Crossword puzzles by themselves probably aren't going to do all that much, at least not that we can measure from our outcomes. But doing something that you like to do, whether that's learning a new language or learning an instrument or crossword puzzles, whatever you like to do, it's important to be engaged cognitively. To keep yourself sharp. And will it stop the proteins? Probably not. But will it keep you cognitively functioning in the healthy range for longer? We think it might, but there's only a scant amount of empirical support for that.
You mentioned learning an instrument, and I did want to ask you about music and Alzheimer's. My father is 94 and very sharp, but he, as a volunteer, plays piano at memory-assisted living places, senior centers, places where people don't remember the names of their relatives. They can't form sentences. Mm-hmm. But when he starts playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, they hum along. Mm-hmm. The music seems to be coming from a deeper, different part of the brain. And yeah. I'm curious about how that, why that is, and whether there are sort of pathways into someone with Alzheimer's through this other part of the brain that can still remember tunes.
The memory is complex. There's so many different forms of memory, and this idea of a musical memory, a procedural memory, which has all these cues. You know, you've got the melody in a song, and all these different structures in a song or in music that can give you context, and that becomes easier to recall. And also, many people have had those experiences where they've heard these songs many, many times over their life, and so they can recall them. But it's something we don't fully understand, and I wish I could give you a more neuroscience-y answer on that. But it is a little bit of a different memory system. More of a procedural-based memory system, which is more preserved than what we call declarative memory or episodic memory.
And it's moving to watch. And I've sometimes gone with him, and people come into the room. They're grumpy and down, and they can't, you know, he'll take requests, and they can't say the name of a song. You know, they're sort of trapped in this inability to speak. But then when he plays something, they know that song, and you can see the body language change. You can see them kind of recover something of the past. I suppose it's also true with childhood memories that remain a lot more intense and present than the, you know, is it known why, and why is that? Why, in terms of how the brain and memory works, why would a childhood memory come back to someone with dementia in their 90s?
Yeah, these are really important aspects of memory. And it's the stuff that happened more recently, like you said, Emily, that these are the kinds of memories that are degraded sooner. Those older memories of childhood, old music, older experiences that have been really ingrained, they're the last memories to go. But eventually they do go in Alzheimer's disease. Hopefully we will have a cure or at least an effective therapy for this so that people don't experience that kind of devastating memory loss. It's dramatic to see what happens, but it's also touching to know that the brain has so much that we don't know about. It's still the organ of the body that is least understood, and to know that playing music can bring a person out of a certain mood or bring them into a different frame of mind, or just the fact that they can remember that, it's pretty incredible, and it's something I hope we can understand in the near future.
I've also seen in listings of here are the symptoms of Alzheimer's, personality changes, with some people becoming quite aggressive, difficult, mm-hmm. Which makes it really hard on caregivers. Why is it that personality changes happen as well as the just pure memory loss?
Yeah, it's so important as we think about this disease to think about the whole person, and they are trying to make sense of their world without the aid of memory anymore. And so when they can't remember their keys or something that they were supposed to be doing, the brain and the mind fill in the gaps. And so a person may become paranoid. A person may become suspicious of others, that their life is being manipulated by others in some way, whether someone's taking their keys or their spouse is cheating on them. There's all kinds of ways that the mind fills in the gaps when when we're unable to make sense of our world.
Depression can, I think, cause memory loss as well. I think that came up in the Nova documentary, that someone who is going through depression may have what appears to be a cognitive decline that isn't Alzheimer's, it's something else. How do you screen for that in your study?
It's an important one. In the older days, they would call that pseudo-dementia many years ago. And it is something that impacts memory. It's something that impacts other aspects of cognition too. We do screen for that. We have self-report mood questionnaires. We ask those every time. We ask in our interviews with our participants, we ask them about their mood and their depressive symptoms. And it's something that we keep track of. And those brain areas involved in mood regulation are some of the same areas that get Alzheimer's pathology in them. They get amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles in those areas that help monitor and regulate and give rise to mood and mood changes.
So that makes another complicated layer in there.
It does, yeah.
You had mentioned when you were talking about exercise, you know, keeping your brain sharp, you alluded to sleep a couple times. Mm-hmm. Is it just that people who sleep more are healthier, or that if they don't sleep well, it could be a sign of something else that's interfering? Or what is it about sleep?
Yeah, all of that. I think it's important to get enough sleep because that helps consolidate memory. And sleep, inadequate sleep.
That's right. I know they've shown that for students who are trying to cram for a test, it actually would be better if they just went to bed instead of staying up late, because somehow your mind kind of almost like cleaning up a house
exactly.
puts things back together.
You have more accurate recollection when you've had adequate sleep. And then a lack of sleep can do other things. First of all, it can be indicative of a problem that could be impacting our cognition, sleep apnea, where we wake up repeatedly in the night and may not be aware of it. That's something that is treatable and can actually improve a person's memory if they can get their sleep apnea treated. There's other more less common diseases, Parkinson's disease, and one that mimics Alzheimer's called Lewy body disease. They can have a dimension of sleep involved in those diseases, like acting out your dreams and things like that. Those are aspects of those diseases that we want to know about when we're evaluating someone for Alzheimer's disease.
You also mentioned as a lifestyle or risk factor thing that diabetes and some other conditions can increase the risk. Can you talk about that and whether it's something where some of those other numbers like high blood pressure or high cholesterol, you know, high mm-hmm. blood sugars, what are some of the other things that if they're not treated can maybe make it worse for Alzheimer's?
It's a little bit complicated, but the gist of the answer is that these other health conditions, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, they can cause vascular changes in their brain. I don't think they're necessarily going to cause Alzheimer's disease. But it is true that if you are not controlling your other health conditions, you may be putting yourself in a vulnerable place with regard to brain health. You may have more vascular changes in your brain, higher risk of stroke, higher risk of subtle, non-detectable strokes, or just very subclinical strokes, we call them, that can accumulate and can cause cognitive impairment all by themselves. So if you put that together with having Alzheimer's too, that gives you extra vulnerability to cognitive impairment.
Is it true that some of the medicines that can be prescribed, like for high cholesterol, such as the statins, that they have some kind of known effect on Alzheimer's as well, or is that a myth?
We think now it might be a myth. That's been an active area of study mm-hmm. for many, many years. We don't think those therapies, statin therapy, high blood pressure therapy, cholesterol therapies and so forth, we don't think that they're impacting the proteins for Alzheimer's disease. But all of these things will be impacting the eventual clinical symptoms, and in other words, the cognitive symptoms of this disease. The more we can keep our minds and brains healthy, the longer we can avoid symptoms if we're destined to get those symptoms in our future because we have the proteins in our brain.
Let me ask you a question about caregivers, because I know that as you've been doing this longitudinal study of over 1,700 people, that you're dealing with people who may have been a caregiver for their parent, or as they start to show signs of the disease, they may have a caregiver that comes with them when they show up for the study. There's a poem that's out there by Owen Darnell. Let me read that and just ask about what you advise caregivers. Do not ask me to remember. Don't try to make me understand. Let me rest and know you're with me. Kiss my cheek and hold my hand. I'm confused beyond your concept. I'm sad and sick and lost. All I know is that I need you to be with me at all cost. Do not lose your patience with me. Do not scold or curse or cry. I can't help the way I'm acting. Can't be different, though I try. Just remember that I need you, that the best of me is gone. Please don't fail to stand beside me. Love me till my life is done. I was wondering if you wanted to comment just about caregivers and the frustration of anyone who is dealing with a loved one with Alzheimer's.
That's such a powerful poem. Yeah, there's such great advice there about just being with our loved one who has this disease and supporting them in whatever way they need without trying to change them or correct them or do things that sort of deny that this disease is there or try to combat it somehow. When a person has dementia, there's not a lot we can do for them at that phase. Up till now, we can talk about some of these therapies that are coming along, but it's so important just to be supportive and to help them through their journey. Caregivers also need support. They need help.
They need respite sometimes.
They need respite. It's such an intense 24/7 job that that we often don't appreciate. Those of us looking at this from the outside may not appreciate the level of effort and care and vigilance that it takes to be a caregiver. And it can take a toll. So having respite, taking care of yourselves as a caregiver becomes so important.
And I think it's very hard. Let's say you're a volunteer where you go in and you talk to someone with Alzheimer's and read to them or massage their hands or do something. If 5 minutes later they don't remember that you were there, it's difficult to know whether that made a difference. That provides another layer, I think, of frustration for a caregiver or volunteer. Mm. Is will it be remembered? Did it make a difference? And how do we know?
Right. Yeah, I think using that as a benchmark may not be all that productive for a caregiver to expect that the one you're caring for is going to remember it and that it's going to tangibly impact them now.
Maybe it's just about the moments, you know,
it's
finding
about
some moments, like when my dad plays music and someone's spirits are brightened for the time of that music.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what we can do is just see, is there a way to provide some joy along the way?
It's about that present moment. It's about providing that joy, about providing those 5 minutes of reading that story to them or playing the song and engaging with them to help enhance their quality of life, even if they may not remember it 10 minutes later.
We're going to talk about some future directions, treatments, kind of some hopeful signs as we talk about Alzheimer's when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. Alzheimer's, you lose your place like in a book. You lose the page in the book of your life. You cannot find the place to put your thumb. One page looks just like another. You look out the window. You wonder where you are. That's from the poem Alzheimer's by William Harris. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Sterling Johnson, and we are talking about preventing Alzheimer's. It is a devastating, terrifying disease. It is just, I think, all of us fear, what if we lose our mind? We don't recognize our loved ones. And it's a terrifying thing. And I want to turn to sort of the aspect of hope that I see in reports of your studies. Can you talk about that? I mean, when you get up and you're ready to go to work on your studies, what gives you hope?
There's so much happening right now in this field, so many discoveries. The RAP study is speaking volumes to us right now. So we are just learning an incredible amount from the study itself. The main thing that we are learning right now is about how early this disease starts. We can actually quantify when this disease begins on an individual basis. Each person is different. So taking this disease to the level of the individual and not necessarily treating everybody as if they're the same and that Alzheimer's behaves the same way in every person. We have the tools, we have the insights to treat this disease as an individual disease in terms of the pathology that is happening in a person's brain. Now we can study things like resilience. We can study things like susceptibility to cognitive impairment. And we can figure out whether all these things we've been talking about, lifestyle and health factors and genetic factors, we can actually understand their effects at the person level. That's super exciting, and that's a major, major groundbreaking thing that RAP is contributing to and pioneering.
And I'll just repeat that RAP stands for the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, a longitudinal study that started in 2001 tracking people at risk for Alzheimer's. I saw on your website something that you're doing which I thought was so important, and that is to meet with the participants and share with them what their work has led to. You know, because so often people are asked to be part of a study and they never know what kind of difference it made.
Right.
But to kind of report to them, you know, look, this is what we're finding. This is how it's helping. You know, that seems like a really important step in it.
We do that at two different levels. We ask them to come together as a group of volunteers, and we present our results to them, kind of like we would present at a conference. We present to our participants and explain it to them and give them a chance to ask questions and then discuss how this might impact their health. And we can do that in a general way with groups of participants. And we also do it on an individual basis. If a person is becoming impaired cognitively, we let them know. We discuss that with them.
And that must be a heartbreaking kind of conversation.
That can be. And we don't always know why it is. If they've done the biomarkers, then we can maybe say a little bit more confidently that we think this might be Alzheimer's. But that's the other thing we are doing more of, is disclosing the results of our biomarker tests to our participants, whether they have amyloid or not in their brain, for example, is an important one.
Is it possible that the group you're looking at is not a typical or control group, in the sense that anyone who volunteers to be a participant in a university medical study, that's someone who is willing to try something new, you know, to take initiative, to go somewhere, to have things happen? They're intellectually engaged in what this might mean.
Who has the luxury of time and so on.
But that you're screening out someone who would be less interested in trying something new. I mean, is it possible that the group you're looking at would be different than the control population?
Yes. That's a very important and valid criticism of a study like this, where it's largely a self-selected study. We put out ads and word of mouth feelers and ask for volunteers. Because so many people are affected by this disease, they're quite willing to join these studies and to do this in honor of their parent or a loved one who had this disease.
In hope that maybe – I know one of the families that was profiled in the documentary was hoping that if studying her after her mother's passing from Alzheimer's might help her son, you know, that it would help that next generation if they made themselves available.
It's an incredible gift. I'm so in awe of these research participants who give of their time and talents and life to be part of this thing. And it's become a point of pride for our participants. They like being They like knowing mm-hmm. that they're contributing to finding answers to this disease.
I know another criticism of lots of medical studies has been that they tend to focus on white men. You know, that if you're going to study hypertension and you study white men, that then the, you know, the prescription dosage recommendations are going to be based on that one population and are not going to do a good job of looking at a broader group. Can you talk about that and your studies of Alzheimer's?
Yeah, I think for us it might be the reverse. It's mostly white women in our study. We have about 67% of our volunteers are women, and the rest are men. We also are working on becoming a more diverse cohort. And right now we're about 18% of our participants are from underrepresented groups who've – by that I mean they've been traditionally less represented in research. And so the applicability of research findings to those individuals from those communities may be in question. And we want to fix that as a study. Our whole field is really focused on fixing that mm-hmm. issue. We want our research to be generalizable to the whole population, to all communities. And in particular, we're working with the African-American community in Madison and Milwaukee especially to get more participants into our study.
And there I'm assuming you have to overcome skepticism because there have been real exploitations, you know, the Tuskegee case, for instance. If you look historically at populations used for research purposes without their consent and without mm-hmm. doing so in a way that involved dignity, how do you combat skepticism that's there for historical reasons?
There are several ways. First of all, we acknowledge that that happened and that was wrong. And we don't do that these days. That is certainly something that that would not happen. We are transparent. We want to partner with our participants. We treat them as partners, not as subjects who we can manipulate or do this or that to. They need to know what we're doing, and we want them to know the impact that they're having. Like I said, through conveying our results back to them, we think that we can help them improve their brain health right now by conveying some of these results back to them. And so we first want to be of service to our participants and the communities they come from. We want them to know that we're here, that we are here for the long haul, not just to get our numbers and to go away, but to actually make a difference in these communities so that we can solve this disease in the communities who are most impacted by it.
Okay, so let's say I'm in your study. I started in 2001, and about, you know, a few years ago, you started seeing memory declines in some of the testing. You've done the blood work and the scans, and it is showing the presence of those two proteins that are the markers for Alzheimer's. What do you then at that point, so my faculties are declining, what can be done to slow the progression? You know, are there drugs I can take in some clinical trial? Are there, mm-hmm. you've mentioned some lifestyle changes, or is it sort of too late once it starts to be apparent?
No, it's not too late. In the summer of 2023, it was a new clinical trial was reported that it's a drug called donanemab that actually pulls amyloid plaques out of the brain and gets a person back to normal levels of amyloid in their brain that are undetectable by our fancy imaging techniques or the new blood tests that we can do.
So is that something that can be started early then?
The minute you see it, you
can start getting that out of there?
That's where we want to be. Right now, the work is being done to lay the foundation for that. And that requires several years' worth of clinical trials. So we've got that donanemab study I just mentioned. That will likely reach approval by the FDA, perhaps by even the end of this year. But before that, we've already got a drug that was approved. Just this summer, in July of 2023, FDA announced the approval of lecanemab, which has full approval. And CMS, the Center for Medicare Studies, it will be paying for this treatment. Imagine removing these plaques that have been there for 10, 20 or more years, they're now being pulled out of the brain. And so is it too late? I guess that's part of the question you're asking is what's the right time to give these drugs? Probably before the symptoms begin would be the mm-hmm. best time.
Once you've identified that those markers are there.
Yes.
You haven't mentioned any attack on the tau protein, the second one, but I assume experiments are underway trying to figure out what to do with that one.
There are experiments underway that target the tau protein specifically. But there's some remarkable things that we're learning from the amyloid drugs is that they also lower, to some degree, tau pathology as well. There's, in particular, this protein called phospho-tau-217 is lowered by amyloid therapy, and that's pretty incredible. So we think intervening along the lines of amyloid is going to help prevent tau as well and address tau. But our field is also working on more direct treatments for the tau proteins themselves.
So you can give people hope in terms of clinical studies underway, more that are probably coming that could point to removing some of these troublesome proteins that are causing Alzheimer's. And then meanwhile, immediate lifestyle changes such as exercise, learning something new maybe? Does doing something new help?
Yeah, learning something new, like we talked about before, an instrument or a language or a new habit or skill is going to form new connections in your brain. New neuronal connections and more synapses and perhaps healthier neurons. Will that stop the Alzheimer proteins from accumulating? Probably not. But it might give you more of a complex network of neurons to rely upon to give you a little bit more of a buffer so that your brain can withstand those Alzheimer lesions that are slowly and progressively growing.
Well, thank you for the work you're doing and for explaining it, too. And I assume people can go to your website. Is there a website you want to mention?
They can go to our website, rap.wisc.edu, rap.wisc.edu. We'll take you to our study. And there you'll see information about how to enroll in the study. We're especially enrolling people who are African-American or Hispanic or from other underrepresented groups. We're interested in rural populations as well right now to understand how those factors influence this disease. So people can, if they're interested in our study, they can enroll. There's also some links there to some important things, our information sessions that I mentioned earlier mm-hmm. where we explain our results to our participants. We have those on our website and a link to the documentary that you mentioned.
It's exciting to see a study right here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the national spotlight right now because of innovative work. My guest has been Sterling Johnson. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Hold on, so I keep holding on to every little memory made of you and me, every little glimpse of who you used to be. I know you're still in there, deep down somewhere, I swear I still see.